This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. Record numbers of people voted on Sunday in Hong Kong's district council elections. They are viewed as a test of support for Chief Executive Carrie Lam following 6 months of often violent pro-democracy protests. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Hong Kong.
This is Hong Kong's first election since anti-government protests began 5 months ago. If long lines outside polling stations are any indication, many Hong Kongers are eager to express their opinion. This voter, Mr. Ma, says he sees the elections as an extension of the protest movement. He says he wants to see a big change. Another voter, Ms. Kwok, says local political offices have been dominated by pro-establishment candidates for years. She says she wants more Democrats in office. Voters are electing district council members, which actually don't have much power. The outcome, though, will be seen as an important measure of public opinion. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Hong Kong.
Pope Francis is demanding world leaders renounce atomic weapons. AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
The pontiff has declared the possession of atomic arsenals unacceptable, going beyond his predecessors to condemn the Cold War-era doctrine of deterrence and demand a complete ban on atomic bombs. Francis made the comments while standing at the Peace Memorial in Hiroshima at the end of a day in which he paid homage to victims of the U.S. atomic bombings there and in Nagasaki, Japan. It was the first full day of a three-day visit. Francis first condemned the possession of nuclear weapons in 2017. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
For more on any of today's top stories, please visit us at voanews.com. And for news on the go, download the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. Iraqi police say security forces opened fire on protesters in southern Iraq, killing at least five people and wounding dozens of others. Continuing weeks of unrest in Baghdad and some southern cities. Police say protesters gathered overnight on three bridges in the city, and security forces used live ammunition and tear gas canisters to disperse them, killing three. More than 50 others were wounded. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 27 people were killed, including some on the ground, when a small plane crashed into a densely populated neighborhood in Goma. At the crash site, residents threw water from buckets and cooking pots onto the smoldering wreckage. A Reuters witness at the scene said two people were rescued before the plane exploded. 22 people have died from measles in Samoa. Reuters reports all the deaths except one were of children younger than 5 years old. The South Pacific Island has declared a state of emergency with nearly 2,000 cases of measles reported. The government has initiated a mass mandatory vaccination program. New York billionaire Michael Bloomberg formally launched his Democratic presidential bid today. AP's Julie Walker reports.
The former New York City mayor made the announcement on his campaign website, writing, "I'm running for president to defeat Donald Trump and rebuild America. We cannot afford four more years of President Trump's reckless and unethical actions. He represents an existential threat to our country and our values. If he wins another term in office, we may never recover." Bloomberg's entrance, just 10 weeks before primary voting begins, reflects his concerns that the current slate of candidates is not well positioned to defeat Trump. Bloomberg also has the personal wealth to make himself a force. He's already reserved more than $30 million in TV ads. Julie Walker, New York.
A United Nations vehicle was targeted in a bombing Sunday in the Afghan capital, Kabul. An Afghan official says initial reports indicate at least one foreign citizen was killed. A girl in India has shattered two world records. Reuters' David Doyle has her story.
8-year-old PDV Saruda from the southern Indian city of Hyderabad has shattered not one, but two world records.
I broke two world records. Those are most number of origami models made by an individual minor female in Bannar, and the second one is most number of ceramic tiles broken by an individual minor female in 20 minutes. I made 202 origami models and broke 350 tiles in 20 minutes.
Saruda's martial arts trainer, Ashwini Anand, says her dedication and confidence is admirable.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. From Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I will build clinic health centers closer to the people because at the moment people have to travel long distances to access health services. So that is one thing. Education. I will have a special fund to fund the students, the school learners, and I will not make education only free at the primary and lower primary level.
Esther Mwinjangi, the first Namibian female presidential candidate, expresses confidence ahead of Wednesday's general election.
Since the administrative bill was received and we went to court to get bail for them, and the court has clarified the sheriff, the state security service has no power under the law. They demand that their sheriff should report in their office for the first clarification. This action is tantamount to contempt of court.
The lead attorney for the Nigerian former presidential candidate files a lawsuit against the director of the state security services.
We continue to monitor what's happening to NGOs. We are encouraging all our members and our partners to ensure that they go and validate and verify their records because we know that this is important, but we also know that the context in which we work is one that can go one way or the other.
And Ugandan NGOs express concern they are being purged for criticizing President Yoweri Museveni and his government. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Voters in Guinea-Bissau are casting their votes for President Sunday. Incumbent José Mário Vaz is among the 12 candidates vying to lead the West African country. He is the first democratically elected president in Guinea-Bissau's history to finish his term. He is up for re-election but is facing stiff competition from several opponents, including former Prime Ministers Carlos Gomes Jr. and Domingo Simoes Pereira. The country's electoral commission is expected to announce the winner of the election a week from today. For the latest developments, I reached Nagna Mbana, a journalist with Capital FM Radio, a viewer affiliate in the capital, Bissau.
Yeah, till now, everything is okay. The people, they went to vote in all in Guinea-Bissau. The people went at 7 o'clock. The people start to vote. At 5, they are going to close. People are reduced to go to vote. But in the morning time, many people, those who stay in the place just to vote, to choose one. Inside the 12 candidates to choose just the preference to be a president in Guinea-Bissau.
What feedback are they telling you about if the president will win re-election?
Yeah, on this time, the people say they are free. They are happy. You can imagine, somebody finished just to vote. Sometimes they are smiling, they show us how they are feeling now. But now we are waiting for time just to close. By next weekend, just to bring up everything about the election. But still now, everything is okay and everything is inside the place where the people are vote.
What did the Electoral Commission say about when they are going to announce who won the election?
Just one week, everything will be like 5 days, 5, 10, 1 week, everything will be by the organization of this election.
Nagna Mbana is a journalist with Capital Radio FM, a viewer affiliate in Guinea-Bissau. He spoke with me from Bissau. In Nigeria, the lead attorney for the detained former presidential candidate Omoyele Sowore has filed a suit against the head of the Department of State Services, Yusuf Bichi, and the attorney general of the Federation, Mr. Abubakar Malami. Sowore and Oluwale Bakari are still being held by the State Security Agency despite an order from a court demanding their release, according to their lead defense attorney, Femi Falana. To learn more about the suit, I reach lead defense attorney, Femi Falana.
What we have done in view of the illegality of the detention of our client is to approach the court to challenge
the action of the State Security Service, and we're asking the court to award them damages of 500 million naira for their immediate detention, each of them. We have also put the engine in motion to have the management of the State Security Service committed for contempt of court, because nobody is above the law in the country.
How pragmatic is this move, and do you think that he will adhere or respond to the suit you have filed against him?
The government has no choice but to come to court and justify why our client is being detained, because it cannot be supported under the law, and even under morality. Once a court has ordered that a citizen be released from custody, nobody has the power to continue to keep him without the order of a higher court. So it is a very pragmatic move, because we cannot engage in criminal actions, or we cannot force our clients out of detention. We can only use the law to challenge each of their illegal detention.
Well, Femi, I'm sure you are aware that the DSS came up with a statement saying effectively that they respect the court ruling and that you and relations of Sowore and your other client, nobody was there to receive them, and that is why they are still keeping them. So if they bring this matter in court...
The SSS has since dropped that childish explanation. The first one was to say nobody showed up. Our lawyers and their family members showed up. The State Security Service changed the story by saying we want their sureties. And we said, no, these are not your sureties. I mean, these are not your sureties, but the sureties of the court. And once the court has approved and verified them, you cannot constitute yourself into a higher court over the federal higher court. Then the State Security Service changed the story again. So the fact that, Sowore and Bakari, as well as Koneda Suki and Elza Kizaki and his wife, are enjoying themselves. Again, as soon as that condition was proposed, the State Security Service changed the story by saying, if we release Sowore, so the truth, if we drop him at our gate, the vehicle may knock him down. Incidentally, I was in Abuja on the day that reckless payment was made. I went to the office of the State Security Service with my car, and I asked them, if you don't want him knocked down by any vehicle in town, I have my car here. Please, can you release him to me? Of course, my request was turned down. These are all desperate moves to keep both gentlemen in detention perpetually.
So now that you filed the case in court, what's next? When does the hearing begin on this?
We are going to find out on Monday. The processes are ongoing. But what is important is that if the State Security Service has granted administrative bail to our clients, it will have been proper to ask for the sureties to be satisfied. But since the administrative bail was refused, and we went to court to get bail for them, and the court has verified the sureties, the State Security Service has no power under the law to demand that their sureties should report in their office for the first verification. This action is tantamount to contempt of court.
Femi Falana is the lead attorney for the detained former Nigerian presidential candidate Omoyele Sowore. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Lagos. Esther Mwinyange is the first female candidate seeking to become the next Namibian president. Ms. Mwinyange is the presidential candidate for the opposition National Unity Democratic Organization, or NUDO party, in the upcoming election scheduled for Wednesday. She faces incumbent President Dr. Hage Geingob from the governing party, the Southwest Africa People's Organization, or SWAPO, in the presidential poll. Analysts say it is unlikely she will pose any electoral threat to incumbent President Geingob, but Mwinyange tells me she remains confident she will significantly win the female vote, which will make her the next Namibian president.
I'm in a race. I'm confident. I'm positive. If I was not confident, I could have not been in the race. So I'm confident that, given the fact that statistically the females are more than men, I'm confident that a lot of the female or women will vote for me.
SWAPO has maintained its political dominance in the country since the country's independence. How confident are you that you'll be able to defeat incumbent President Haige Geingob, who people are predicting will win by an overwhelming majority?
I'm not so sure about that win or victory for him. You know, we have been now 30 years independent, and under the SWAPO-led government, we have seen a lot of things going down. The economy in the country, poor education, poor health services, corruption on a daily basis. As we speak now, we have ministers who have been arrested because of corruption. So I don't know what is it that the SWAPO-led government will do different this time around. What is it that they will still want to do that they could not achieve in the past 30 years?
How has been the response of Namibians towards you? Because your party is seen as a minor political party, but you are confident. Since women overwhelmingly outnumber men in the voter register, you believe women will vote for you. So how have they been responding to you so far ahead of the elections?
You know, this is it's a history that was made in Namibia. It's something that nobody expected that it will happen. When I was running for the presidency of the party, everyone was like, oh my goodness, what is he trying to do? But, you know, I made it, and that also gave hope to many women, to many young women, for women to start believing that we have a place in our society, in our community. So that is something that is bringing hope in the people, in the Namibians. I remember that after my victory, a lot of women called me and they said, you know, we have started to lose hope in the politics of this country. But now that things are changing, you know, you are instilling hope in us. So that made me to believe that I should remain hopeful. And it's good, even if I don't make it, I will not look at that as a lose, but I will look at that as a learning opportunity. And I would look at what went wrong, what did I not do, what I can do next time. So I will keep on trying.
If the people of Namibia repose confidence in you by voting for you to become the next president, what should be their expectation and what would you do for them?
First of all, my theme is restoring the dignity of the Namibian. So every system, health system, I will build clinics, health centers closer to the people, because at the moment people have to travel long distances to access health services. So that is one thing. Education, I will have a special fund to fund the students, the school learners, and I will not make education only free at the primary and lower primary levels, but higher education as well, because at the moment we are claiming that education is free, but when you are going to the university, if you cannot afford, then you cannot go to the university. We have at the moment a loan that the government is providing students, but there is no mechanism for the government to raise for the students who get the loan and who start working to pay back that loan. So in that process, the other students who are coming cannot get benefit from the loan scheme. For those who are living in shanty houses, formal settlement, without proper toiletries and proper water and, you know, access to basic facilities, I will have a special fund that I can give vouchers for people to buy building materials so that they can have decent homes. I will renegotiate the contracts that the governments have at the moment with the Chinese. That need to be renegotiated so that it can benefit all the Namibians, because what is happening right now is that the Chinese companies are bringing in Chinese from China, and they are in the construction enterprise. So the Namibians don't get a job. There is no opportunity for them to build capacity, and there is no transfer of skills because the Chinese are being brought in.
Esther Mwinyange is the presidential candidate for the Namibian Opposition National Unity Democratic Organization, or NUDO Party. She spoke with me from the capital, Windhoek. The executive director of the Ugandan National NGO Forum says members of the group will continue to engage the authorities to address their concerns regarding the re-registration of NGOs in the East African country. Richard Sewakirianga says the government should engage with the NGOs as a confidence-building measure to encourage them to register. His comments follow reports that over 12,000 charities may lose the ability to function. For reaction to the ongoing registration of NGOs, I reach Richard Sewakirianga, the executive director of the Ugandan National NGOs Forum in the capital, Kampala.
There was a press conference by the Minister of Internal Affairs, the State Minister of Internal Affairs, where he read the press statement about the verification and validation exercise of NGOs. Now, the thing is that he did make some remarks of CAF, where he mentioned that if organizations don't register, they will be closed. But the statement that he issued was clear that the organizations had a window to go and register, especially those that were not able to register for various reasons, including the fact that they couldn't get internet connection. So that is what the issue is.
But Richard, a lot of Ugandans are saying the window giving the NGOs to register are enough time to ensure that these NGOs effectively follow the measures being implemented by the government. So why are NGOs complaining that the government is not being fair and trying to purge so-called critics of the administration?
We did write to the minister to tell him that the time given to the NGOs was very short. To register 14,000 NGOs in 1 month is quite a lot of work to do verification and the validation. So that is something that we mentioned to the minister. We wrote to him asking that the time is extended. They didn't answer back, but they didn't give us an extension until now when they created this thing. Of course, because of the actions that have taken place in the past, one cannot rule out the fact that there could be ways in which this verification and validation exercise could be used. But we continuously have been getting assurances from the NGO Bureau, which is the regulatory body, that this exercise is purely exercise to ensure that we have a clean database. So we want to take them on their word.
Now, there are concerns that some NGOs are just there, they are ineffective, they are not doing anything. Others are saying that if you are not effective and you have been given a window to register for validation and all that, why not simply go ahead and do it? There are so many places you can go to get adequate internet to register. How do you respond to such criticisms?
People sort of always want to think that NGOs, there are very many and they're doing nothing. But if you look at this country, if there were no NGOs, you may find that you wouldn't even have lots of services in this country. If you go to the health sector, nearly 80% of the health, primary health and other services, there is a huge complement that the NGOs give. So for me, the criticism that NGOs are doing nothing is actually not very true, because a country like Uganda, the government really needs so many people to complement their services. On the issue of the internet connection, it's not many. Mostly NGOs upcountry. But they are also, you have said before, from the context you have laid out before, that there are NGOs that refuse to register because they were suspicious about the process.
What are you going to do about this suspicion that perhaps NGO critics of the government are being purged or are being deregistered?
Well, the thing is that for us, we continue to be in constant dialogue with the NGO Bureau, which is a regulatory body, to continuously share information about the concerns that NGOs have. We continue to monitor what's happening to NGOs. We are encouraging all our members and our partners to ensure that they go and validate and verify their records, because we know that this is important, but we also know that the context in which we work is one where we can go one way or the other.
Richard Sewakirianga is the executive director of the Uganda National NGOs Forum. He spoke with me from Kampala.
Underprivileged Zimbabweans are receiving free medical service under a crowdfunding initiative started by Zimbabweans living in the United States. Pensioners earning paltry pensions who can't afford private medical services are benefiting. For VOA, Kuzanai Musengi has more from Bulawayo.
68-year-old Jack Mpofu is currently walking with the help of crutches. Earlier in the year, he was treated at Mpilo, the second biggest government referral hospital in the country, after experiencing persistent pain in his lower back. Mpofu says the pain returned a few weeks ago, and he decided to come to Bulawayo West Memorial to be re-examined after he had heard that the private polyclinic was offering free medical services to people like him. Mpofu, who fought in Zimbabwe's liberation war against the white minority, receives a monthly gratuity of 500 Zimbabwean dollars, but in a country ravaged by cyclic hyperinflation, this is hardly enough for daily basics, let alone medical treatment. He says he found some doctors in attendance and was examined for free. I'm a pensioner, and I get a pension of 500 Zimbabwean dollars per month. For me to go to private hospitals is unthinkable because everything is expensive there and I can't afford it. I'm really happy about this initiative. Another local, Willias Dube, told VOA he also benefited from the initiative. He has lately been experiencing numbness in his left arm. Dube says he was relieved that he was treated for free and also got free medication. He says if he had gone to another place, he would have spent more than 300 Zimbabwean dollars. For one to travel from this place to Mpilo and back, one needs $10, and when you get there, you will most likely not be treated because the doctors are not there and there is no medication. Bulawayo West Memorial is the first medical institution to participate in a program dubbed Citizens Clinics, which was started through crowdfunding led by Freeman Chari, a Zimbabwean living in the United States. The initiative has raised more than $5,000 so far and is roping in volunteer physicians, some of whom were recently fired by the government for striking. The program is targeting the vulnerable, especially the elderly and under fives, who under normal circumstances get subsidized treatment in government hospitals and clinics. Dr. Atmo Chakanyuka is the director of Bulawayo West Memorial. He says they have deliberately targeted those who can't afford to access alternative services in the private sector.
Most can't afford the private care prices, considering the current hardships, and considering that those people, normally the government caters for them by offering free treatment. So we thought we could chip in whilst the government situation restores to normal.
But Dr. Chakanyuka says they use their discretion and can also help those outside the given age groups. A junior doctor recently fired by government in the ongoing strike, speaking on condition of anonymity, told VOA that he decided to volunteer in this initiative because he fully understands the situation in the government hospitals.
The hospitals have been closed for almost 2 months now, and from there, most of our patients, they've lost follow-up. So we have decided as doctors, we've got spare time at the meantime, to just get into this community and try to assist patients whom we see cannot afford to go and get assistance in the private sector.
Zimbabwe's health system, affected by years of economic meltdown, has been thrown into a new crisis by the stalemate between junior doctors and government. The government says there are about 1,600 junior doctors registered under the Statutory Health Services Board. The government is also in the process of firing most of them as they have not heeded calls to return to work. They say their salaries are now too low and as a result cannot afford to report for duty on a daily basis as expected. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them, and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices on VOA.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, it has been 2,050 days today when Nigerian militants abducted the Chibok school girls. Some of the kidnapped girls have been released, but others remain in captivity. The Bring Back Our Girls campaign, an advocacy group, has been putting pressure on the government to expedite action to ensure all of the abducted girls are returned to their parents. Iman Shehu is a prominent member of the Bring Back Our Girls group. He joins me live here in the VOA studios in Washington. How are you, Iman?
I'm fine, Peter.
So talk to me, what is the latest development in your drive and push to pressure the government to ensure the girls are returned home safely to their parents?
Well, like you said, today it's 2,050 days since the girls, since the abduction took place in Chibok and became a global issue, mm-hmm. and which give birth to the advocacy, the Bring Back Our Girls movement. So the advocacy has continued, even though some of the girls have been brought back, but it's 5 years and some months now since this happened. And true to the philosophy of the movement, we have continued with the sit-out, and we have continued with intermittent efforts to engage government and to see that the remaining girls are brought back.
So how would you rate the effort of the government with the pressure that you've put on officials of the administration? How would you rate their efforts?
Well, we would say that the administration seems to have lost the fervor to get the girls back, because unlike what happened when they were able to get all those girls back except the 112 that are still with the insurgents, we just keep hearing statements occasionally saying something is being done, and that's not very encouraging, because we know the parents are not being engaged, nothing is being told to the parents, and we know how traumatic this can be, and so we've continued to insist that even if for security reasons government doesn't want to share with the public what's going on, it's necessary that the parents of those who are still in captivity should be regularly briefed. And since this is not taking place for us, it means not much is happening.
I heard some reports that some of your advocacy work sometimes get blocked by security officials. You want to present petitions that supposedly don't go well. How is this going on, and how are these parents feeling at this moment? Because sometimes I know they participate in some of your activities.
Yeah, the parents have not been happy. Some of them have relocated back to Chibok. A couple of them are still in Abuja. One of them, in fact, took part in the activity we had on day 2000. When it was 2000 days, the lady came and virtually broke down in the course of the event. But you see, the attitude of blocking the advocacy is a standard procedure with most African governments, sadly. There's a failure to understand that a movement like the Bring Back Our Girls movement is also concerned about the progress of the country. The Chibok abduction is a slight and a big sore on the country, and as long as this sore is not... As long as there is no closure, then this so continues to be an embarrassment to the country.
But what do you say to supporters of the government who accuse your group of playing politics ahead of elections and trying to undermine the administration in the run-up to the elections, and saying some of your members politicize the issue? What do you say to them?
Well, it's not true, because part of the approach of the Bring Back Our Girls movement has been that we are not pro any political party. We are holding every administration accountable, because it is the responsibility of government to ensure the safety of every citizen, and the Chibok girls are Nigerian citizens, regardless of the fact that they come, so to say, from the outbacks of the country and come from a less privileged demographic of the country. But and therefore, our concern is to ensure that government does what it does. Government must be held accountable. We cannot run governance without the main actors being held accountable by the constitution of the country. So it's not a matter of politicization.
Before we go, Iman, what is the message here to the government and these insurgents? Because it appears sometimes the insurgents attack the very people, the military, that is supposed to protect life and property.
Yeah, well like we've said all along, the ours is not to recommend military solutions. We are citizens. Our advocacy is essentially to ensure that citizens who are caught in the crossfire between the insurgents and the military are brought to safety, especially the Chibok girls. Government should still find a way of ensuring that this insurgency is brought to an end, and the insurgents should also realize that if they cannot win the battle, which is very obvious, they are just wasting lives, it's time for them to change their strategy and talk.
Thank you very much. Iman Shehu is a prominent member of the Bring Back Our Girls group in Nigeria. He joined me live in the viewer studios right here in Washington, D.C. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sport. Eliud Kipchoge and Dalila Muhammad have been named the Male and Female World Athletes of the Year. The announcement was made at the World Athletics Awards 2019, held at the Grimaldi Forum in Monaco on Saturday. Kipchoge, the winner of the award last year, captured his fourth victory at the London Marathon in April with a 2-hour, 2 minutes and 37 seconds course record, the third fastest performance of all time. The 35-year-old Kenyan followed up in October by blasting through the distance 2-hour barrier with a 1 hour, 59 minutes and 40 seconds performance in Vienna. Mohamed broke the world record in the 400 meters hurdles twice this year, first with a 52.20 performance at the U.S. Championships in July. The 29-year Mohamed broke it again at the World Athletics Championships Doha 2019, clocking 52.16. Mohamed also won world gold in the 4x400 meters relay and won 5 of her 7 races. The award for the male rising star went to Solomon Barega. The 19-year-old Barega was the silver medalist in the 5,000 meters at the World Championships and finished 5th in the senior race at the World Cross Country Championships 2019. The Ethiopian also produced world under-20 leads at both the 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters, with 12.53.04 and 26.49.46 respectively. Yaroslava Mahochik took the Female Rising Star Award. Mahochik, the 2017 World Under-18 High Jump Champion, twice broke the World Under-20 record, first with a leap of 2.02 meters and again with a clearance of 2.04 meters to secure the silver medal. The 18-year-old also won the European Under-20 title. And Brahima Sankar Dabo won the Fair Play Award. Dabo, a distant runner from Guinea-Bissau, made headlines around the world after he helped fellow runner Jonathan Busby of Aruba to the finish line during the opening round heat of the 5,000 meters at the World Championships. Busby was near collapse with about 200 meters left in the race when Dabo stopped to help his distressed fellow competitor. And in football, an extra time goal from Ramadan Sobhi helped Egypt beat Ivory Coast 2-1 to lift the 2019 Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations trophy on Friday. Ivory Coast and Egypt had already booked their spots for Tokyo 2020 by winning their semi-finals. The final went into extra time with Ramadan Sobhi winning the trophy for Egypt with a goal in the 114th minute. The final came soon after a dramatic third-place playoff match where South Africa clinched the third African place at the 2020 Olympics with a penalties win over Ghana after the match had ended 2-2. The dramatic win for South Africa means they have qualified for the men's football tournament at the Olympics in Tokyo next year, along with the under-23 finalists Ivory Coast and hosts Egypt. South Africa also won a third-place playoff 4 years ago as they beat Senegal on penalties to earn a place at the 2016 Olympics in Rio. And South Africa have turned down an approach to step in as emergency hosts of next year's Women's Africa Cup of Nations finals. It means the Confederation of African Football, CAF, have to find a country to hold the tournament. Congo pulled out of the hosting of the 12-team tournament in July. South Africa are one of the 7 candidates seeking to host the 2023 Women's World Cup and have a 13th December deadline to provide hosting agreement guarantees and submit detailed bid plans to FIFA. There has been no date set for the 2020 Women's Africa Cup of Nations, but is usually held in the second half of the year. The last finals were in Ghana. Finally, in boxing, Deontay Wilder knocks out Luis Ortiz with a single punch in round 7 of heavyweight rematch. Unbeaten WBC heavyweight champion Deontay Wilder broke open a one-sided fight in which he was being outboxed in round 7 with one straight right hand that finished Ortiz via a devastating knockout in their pay-per-view rematch at the MGM Grand Garden Arena. The 34-year-old Wilder made the 10th defense of the title he won in 2015 and kept alive plans for a February 2020 rematch against unbeaten linear champion Tyson Fury by scoring a second stoppage defeat over the often avoided Ortiz. And that's about it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Michelle Montano with Memory, and then Mao Sama X Handstone with Iakote, and then Imboso comes next with Ate. Adina featuring Kwame Eugene with Killing Me Softly. We'll let it.
Girl, I want you to know when I'm with you. Taking over me, and I would never leave.
Yeah, yeah.
When I'm with you, I don't ever feel like letting go. Don't let me go.
Hey. So let we make a memory.
Memory.
We jam in that picture way, like a movie they'll be watching way. So let we make a memory.
Memory.
Take a shot inside of you.
no lisi peleze ni kagarakara wabaya macho wasi sogele tuende Zanzibari Komoro Mombasa tucheze sumari ndomboro chakacha nikupe michezo hatari usidi takata tuwe ngari ngari dangote tanasha kama kikogwa nitala na chungu ate ate Mboga mboga sangara uduwe ate 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 iyanaya ate 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 iyanaya ate 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 mimi dakitari dakitari wa mapenzi Dozi yangu temethali inatibu na kuenzi yangu tamtam bila kuchanjia chacho kwa kudambulia swafi kwa kuitumia ni salama kama babu kama tatafunia dafu kwa kusukumia chakuru magia ginyama benzi liogele hibali salama selele Kule tuji soso moi, nyama nyama za shawarma Habibi selelea Tuende Zanzibari, Komoro Mombasa Tucheze zumari, ndomboro chakacha Nikupe michezo hatari, uzidi takata Tue ngari ngari, dangote tanasha Kikogwa nitala na chungu ate 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 mboga mboga sangara uduvi ate 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 ya na ya ate 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 ya na ya ate 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 Anania anaita analilia anaita akashikilia anaita nimpe yote yote yani mzima mzima kulamba lamba chocolate ya maziwa yote yote
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, it was reported that some citizens of the Democratic Republic of the Congo were physically attacking peacekeepers of the United Nations and also leveling serious criticism against them. The cause for their anger was that the United Nations peacekeeping forces have failed to protect civilians and that they ought to leave the country. The issue of United Nations protection of civilians is not new. And in other situations in Africa, the same complaint has been made. People's minds go way back to Rwanda, what was considered a failure of the United Nations to prevent what I'm calling genocide. But the issue of protecting civilians is not an easy one. Usually, when the Security Council adopts a mandate for a force, it attaches the language of the mandate protecting civilians. But strictly speaking, the concept of peacekeeping does not involve enforcement. But nowadays, no one makes the distinction between peacekeeping, which is non-enforcement, and enforcement forces under Chapter 7 of the Charter. That's the first complication. Secondly, when the Secretary General approaches member states to make contribution to a UN peacekeeping force in the DRC, the troop contributors are under the impression that their contingents will not be engaged in conflict. As such, they inform the commander of their contingent that they should not be involved in combat. In many countries of the world, it could be a political problem if their troops in the United Nations start coming home in body bags. Do not forget what happened to President Clinton in Somalia when American troops were killed and the bodies were dragged in the street of Mogadishu. President Clinton had no other option but to withdraw all United Nations forces from Somalia. Secondly, when the force commander meets with the troop contributors' managers, he has to make sure that they know what it will entail if they were asked to protect civilians in the conflict zone. We saw this in the Congo in 1960-64, and it resulted in casualties of United Nations peacekeeping forces. So that needs to be clarified. But this is not an easy matter. There are a lot of complications because you cannot justify having a UN force and then civilians being killed. What is necessary is if the Security Council is sending a force in the conflict zone and that there is a mandate for the protection of civilians, then it will be wise if the Secretary General approaches only those countries that are willing to sacrifice in the protection. And there are many of them. People forget the casualties sustained by Nigeria, by Guinea and Ghana in ECOMOC's peacekeeping in Sierra Leone and Liberia. Then the Security Council must be very clear in its mandate definition. This is essential so that the UN does not get itself wrapped up in all of this conflict, because still civilians have been killed in Mali, and therefore there is a need for much more training of the commander of contingents to make sure that they know. There was a time in Sierra Leone when a group of boys called the West Side Boys were harassing civilians in the key traffic zone. The UN could not intervene. And the usual answer of the UN commander is that they have not come to the country to fight wars. So while it is understandable that the people of the DRC are unhappy that the UN is not going to protect them, they have to understand that it's not an easy job and that one which needs further clarification for all. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdun, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.